Tiananmen Square then and now. Today, Wednesday, June 4th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. 25 years ago, the Chinese government cracked down hard on protesters in Tiananmen Square and on the foreign journalists who were there covering it.
The government has ordered us to shut down our facility. We are shutting down our facility.
Can we sign off?
Now a new generation of Chinese is looking back at 1989.
The Tiananmen Square incident is like an open and unhealed wound in China's history.
Also, how undocumented immigrants are preparing to get their driver's licenses in California. The road test, by the way, is not the problem.
In Mexico, it's harder to drive. If you come from Mexico City, you are like a PhD.
Plus, why do koalas cling to trees? That's ahead on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and you are listening to The World. Today marks the 25th anniversary of an event that, at the time, seemed certain to radically change China's future, and perhaps even the future of America's relationship with China. I'm talking about the Chinese government's brutal crackdown on demonstrators in Tiananmen Square. China has changed a lot since that day in 1989, but not exactly in the ways we might have expected back then. The Communist Party still rules, for starters, and it does its best to ignore this anniversary. So to start the show today, we present you a tale of two Chinas, one that remembers the events of June 4th, 1989, all too well.
We believe deeply we were really doing good for the people and for the country.
And another that doesn't know or care that much about Tiananmen at all.
We feel a bit irrelevant and sometimes even indifferent about the incident.
More on that indifference in a minute. Let's begin, though, with the story of Shen Tong. He was one of the student leaders in Tiananmen 25 years ago. Speaking to our friends at the BBC recently, Shen recalled how he helped present the protesters' demands to Chinese authorities.
The students from the very beginning wanted something somewhat contradictory. We wanted the student organization independence, but also we're very, very clear we were for reform, not for revolution. For better or for worse, we're not against communist rule. Our most serious demand was simply to have a public platform that we call having a dialogue.
But the Chinese government, of course, wasn't having any of it. On the night of June 3rd, the People's Liberation Army sent thousands of soldiers to break up the protest in Tiananmen. The soldiers shot their way toward the square, killing scores of demonstrators. Shen Tong says he witnessed many of the killings, but he was lucky. He escaped with his life and managed to fly out into exile. Today, he's in New York. And as he looks back on what happened 25 years ago, he's not sure what effect those deaths had on China.
The historian in me and the very realistic, grumpy social activist in me don't really see a clear path to a brighter future. We had such an amazing opportunity 25 years ago, and China unfortunately missed it. History was not kind to us. But as a social activist, you're almost eternally optimistic. I do believe what I stood for and among millions of other students were right and was basic. We missed such a great opportunity, but I remain hopeful.
That's Shen Tong there speaking recently to the BBC. The former Tiananmen student leader now lives in exile in New York. I got a very different perspective on the events 25 years ago from Kai Wong. She's one of our colleagues at the BBC in London. She was in Beijing at the time of the Tiananmen protests and crackdown, but she was just a year old. She's now 26 and still struggles to fully understand what happened in 1989.
When you go to Tiananmen Square nowadays, you see the giant portrait of Chairman Mao and you see the spacious square, but you can hardly think about the tank man who stood exactly the same place that you are standing today, 25 years ago.
The tank man, of course, is a reference to that famous picture of a lone protester standing defiantly in the path of a tank during the crackdown. Wong says she didn't even hear about Tiananmen or see that picture until she was 14. She was still in Beijing then, and she learned about the 1989 protests from a journalist.
To be honest, I still know little about what really happened, or I'm still trying to find out the truth.
So was it talked about at all when you were growing up, or was the story just somehow different?
We didn't really talk about it in public because it's banned. You can't learn it from any textbooks, and also you can't learn it by yourself from the internet because of the censorship. I learned more after coming to the UK by accessing to those so-called forbidden books, and, you know, also in theatres and, you know, via people who I know who participated in the movement. But you receive conflicting informations from all directions, and for people like me who are in their 20s, is still, you know, jigsaw pieces. You never get to know a full picture of what really happened on the day.
And when you did start to learn about this after you were 14 and then a little bit more when you made it to the UK, did your views about the country change at all, about the government?
Not really. Personally, I think not only myself, but also my generation feels the event itself feels a bit irrelevant to us because...
Irrelevant?
Irrelevant in a way. It's just like the born free generation in South Africa who didn't go through the apartheid era. And for us, we didn't experience or didn't feel the incident ourselves. And we were not allowed to talk about and knew little about it. So we feel a bit irrelevant and sometimes even indifferent about the incident. And also compared to the older generation, I think our generation is less politically conscious about the whole thing. We grew up in the atmosphere of nationalism, and also we are the generation who experienced 2 decades of rapid economic growth in China. So compared to our predecessors, I think we are more materialistic and realistic, and they were more idealistic in a way.
It's hard to say what effect Tiananmen Square, the demonstrations 25 years ago, had on present-day China, but certainly China is hugely different from how it was then. Do you see any connection between what happened then and how China is now?
Sometimes I ask myself, what's the legacy of Tiananmen Square? The Tiananmen Square incident is more like an open and unhealed wound in China's history. It's different from other student movements in China's history. I mean, in retrospect of the history, there were a couple of prominent student movements in China. For example, the May 4th movement in 1919 is an anti-imperialist movement. But with Tiananmen Square, you can hardly see any trace of it nowadays. And it didn't really achieve anything at the end from my own perspective. And also, for people like me who live in a country like China and their limited freedom of speech, you are not really get involved in politics throughout your life. So that's why we felt a bit detached from politics. Mm-hmm. And we care more about our own future rather than the country's bigger future. Young people nowadays, they care about if they can get a good job after graduated from university and if they can live a comfortable life rather than the big picture or the big future of the country.
That was my colleague at the BBC and Beijing native, Kai Wong. Here in the U.S., TV viewers got a really good look at what was happening in Tiananmen Square 25 years ago. That's because it was one of the first examples of a big breaking international news story that was covered live. The day-to-day coverage of the Tiananmen protests had Americans riveted. But the reason there was so much news coverage of those 1989 events was a fluke. Here's the world's Matthew Bell.
All the big TV networks were there.
The world's largest public square has now become the scene of the biggest demonstration in the history of communist China.
The news media didn't rush to Beijing to cover the protests, though. They were already in China to report on something completely different.
It was an accident of history that led to so many foreign journalists being in Beijing during the spring of 1989.
Mike Chinoy was CNN's Beijing bureau chief.
It was only because the Chinese were hosting Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev for this historic summit that would put an end to the 30-year-long Sino-Soviet dispute that prompted Beijing to agree to let so many international media come to China.
Chinese officials were so hot for publicity, they gave the networks permission to put satellite dishes, microwave transmitters, and extra crew in the place where Gorbachev would get his grand welcome, Tiananmen Square.
And then the protesting students literally stole the stage on which this Gorbachev summit pomp and ceremony was to have been played out.
When the demonstrations became the story, the Chinese government moved to put a lid on it. Chinoy describes it all in a documentary he's produced called Assignment China, about the history of American journalists who worked there. At CNN's headquarters in Beijing, two Chinese officials showed up at one point to shut them down. So the network went live and viewers could see exactly what was happening.
The government has ordered us to shut down our facility. We are shutting down our facility.
Can we sign off?
Yeah, let's be burning.
That's the story to the moment. For all of the hardworking men and women of CNN, goodbye from Beijing.
That live sign-off by CNN's Bernard Shaw was a historic moment for broadcast news, Chinoy says. For the Chinese government, though, the student-led protests upstaging the Soviet summit was an enormous embarrassment, and the intense media scrutiny made it even worse.
Must have been incredibly humiliating and infuriating to Chinese leaders, and to Deng Xiaoping in particular. This was going to be the crowning diplomatic achievement of his career. So that certainly was one of the factors that led into their decision to crack down.
Do you hear that gunfire?
Fire, we do hear it.
Okay, we've got to get out of here.
When Chinese soldiers shot their way into Tiananmen Square on the night of June 3rd, Richard Roth was reporting live from the scene by cell phone for CBS. It didn't take long for an army squad to go after Roth and his cameraman. This is what viewers heard live on the air.
This is New York. Does anybody hear us? This is New York. Does anybody hear us?
The CBS crew got roughed up and detained, but in the end, they were lucky. They weren't too badly hurt. Looking back, Mike Chinoy says foreign reporters covering the Tiananmen story made some mistakes. They tended to oversimplify the demonstrations, for example, as a Western-style pro-democracy movement.
The need for sort of journalistic shorthand to simplify explains why this became known as pro-democracy movement, which in the West and in the States, I think, was seen as sort of Western-style democracy, when the reality was the students were very idealistic, and some of them, a lot of them talked about democracy, but I don't really think they had any clear notion of what they meant by that.
But on balance, Chinoy says the international media did pretty well covering an episode that will haunt authoritarian governments in China for years. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Before we take a short break, just a note, looking ahead to the World Cup soccer tournament. It starts next week, and there's a lot of excitement out there for the big event, not just around the globe, where soccer is the sport of choice, but here in the U.S. too. And we need your help on how to best enjoy the event. Specifically, what are the best spots around to go watch World Cup matches in good company? You know, maybe a watering hole that serves up Belgian beer, where the Red Devils will be the stars of the show. Or a restaurant that serves up Ghanaian food while you watch the Black Stars take on Portugal. Help us out. Where will you be watching the World Cup to cheer on your team? Help us fill out our World Cup bar finder at PRI.org. I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. Last month, Moner Mohammed Abu-Salha became the first American to act as a suicide bomber in Syria. Abu-Salha was born and grew up in Florida. His family and neighbors there are still trying to figure out how he ended up a jihadi. Abu-Salha reportedly emailed his family to say he was in Jordan caring for wounded fighters. In reality, he was becoming deeply involved in Syria's civil war. One question of deep concern to authorities in America and elsewhere is this: how common is this kind of story? A new report out today by the RAND Corporation says the ranks of jihadist fighters worldwide has doubled in the last 3 years. RAND's Seth Jones is the report's author. He says that when he looked at the recent growth of militant groups, one thing quickly became apparent.
a lot of the increase in fighters was coming from Syria. And our data actually verified that, yes, Syria is clearly front and center to this increase in attacks, in fighters, and in groups.
Should people be more afraid now, given the results of your survey?
No, I don't think people should be more afraid. But I think they should be aware that globally, there is a very important ideological struggle going on, including within Islam, between moderate views of Islam and some small numbers of extremists, though they're growing, that are trying to hijack the religion and use it to overthrow regimes. Many people had hoped recently that these kind of jihadist groups were in decline, and that does not appear to be the case. So I don't think Americans should be more afraid. In fact, what we found is that the threat to attacks in the U.S. homeland is probably less today than it was in the 2009 period and certainly in the post-2001-2002 world.
Seth, it all just seems so hopeless, you know, trying to get these guys back from joining these groups. What do you do?
Where we've seen groups like Al-Qaeda suffer greatly, it's been in places like Saudi Arabia where in 2003 and 4 and 5, they were involved in an intense campaign with strikes in Riyadh and a number of other cities. And the Saudi response, though it did involve some fairly repressive measures, the capture and killing of some Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula leaders, it also involved an intense struggle of ideas. Saudi clerics, Sunni clerics, stood up in mosques, got out on radio and television, on the internet, and denounced these extremists as being un-Islamic, as attempting to hijack the regime. There is a very, very important component of this that must be about a struggle of ideas, of hearts and minds.
Seth Jones is a terrorism expert at the RAND Corporation. He's been talking to us about his new report on the rise of jihadi groups around the world. Seth Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Brazil, as you might have heard, is rushing to prepare for the World Cup soccer tournament that starts next week and for the arrival of hundreds of thousands of foreign fans. Some in Brazil worry that many of those visitors could be looking for something other than soccer in between games. They worry about a spike in prostitution, especially child prostitution. Rira Davies reports from Brazil for our partners at the BBC. He sent us this report from the northeastern state of Bahia.
Just a block from the beach in the northern city of Recife, music blares from the open boot of a car. Men stand around drinking and watching a group of women a few yards away. This is the city's red light district. But the difference here is that while they may dress and make themselves up like women, some of these girls are only just in their teens. One in four sex workers here is thought to be a child. Pregnant at 16, her own childhood already lost. Anna says she's not a prostitute, but has been having sex since she was 12. She says girls here go with foreigners because they're wealthy and generous. When her mother went to the police, they didn't even recognize Anna as a victim.
I've got lots of friends who go with foreigners, gringos. They come here for the girls, you know, working girls. The guys have lots of money and give them lots of things, like place to live or jewelry.
With its long white beaches, Recife is one of Brazil's fastest growing cities, an increasingly popular destination, and where four World Cup games will be played this summer.
The growth of this region economically and as a tourist destination has brought thousands of workers here, people from other parts of Brazil and from overseas. But according to aid workers, these villages aren't just full of tourists. They're often frequented by men looking for sex, and that's often sex with children. Where there's poverty, children are often vulnerable. These self-awareness groups help girls who grow up in these tough neighbourhoods to spot the warning signs.
15, 13, 14, menina nova.
15, 13, 14-year-old girls, she says. For the equivalent of £6, they'll go with a guy and do just about anything just so they have money to buy drugs.
Comprar pedra, tomar maconha.
Martela, martela.
Brazilian society is often accused of sexualizing children. The novinha phenomenon, internet videos and songs portraying young girls as attainable sexual objects. Jessica Barbosa is from the British charity ActionAid, which has several projects in the area.
It's a situation that we think that's going to be worse in the World Cup because they have men from outside. We have vulnerable girls who need money and who think that they have a better life in other countries. And we have no serious public policies to prevent the situation.
No, no é amigo. É tipo assim.
12-year-old Andrea is proof of that. She has not been abused, but only thanks to her mother's vigilance. She tells me how she's unable to rely on the law to stop older men harassing or trying to lure her daughter with gifts from clothes to popcorn. So she's had to make her a virtual prisoner in her own home. A high-profile global campaign fronted by English and Brazilian footballers warns World Cup visitors not to take advantage of Brazil's reputation for easy sex.
Paying for sex with anyone aged 17 or under is absolutely illegal in Brazil.
In this World Cup city, kids high on drugs sell themselves for the price of a cup of coffee. It's an ugly business that embarrasses Brazil when the country is showing itself off to the world.
A reminder there that it won't all be fun and games in Brazil during the upcoming World Cup. That was our BBC colleague Wira Davies reporting from Recife. We're going to be keeping a close eye on Brazil over the next month and a half. That includes a special edition of the program next week, entirely dedicated to the World Cup. This is The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. A former White House chef remembers getting a note ahead of a dinner honoring a special guest.
It said, "Does not eat onions, garlic, and tomatoes." And I read it 6 times to make sure I was reading all the words correctly.
The kicker? The guy was Italian. It's true. Coming up, the sometimes dicey intersection of food and diplomacy. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. So, deserter or POW? That's the debate now over Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, that and whether President Obama should have authorized a prisoner swap with the Taliban to obtain Bergdahl's freedom. Today, the Taliban released a video showing the moment the American soldier was released last Saturday. In the video, you can see a Taliban fighter speak to Bergdahl just before he's whisked off by a waiting U.S. helicopter. The fighter warns him, "Don't come back to Afghanistan. Next time, you won't get out alive." The U.S. Army is still investigating how Bergdahl wound up being captured 5 years ago. It'll be a while before we know exactly what happened. But believe it or not, this would not be the first time returning POWs get in trouble with military brass. The World's History Desk has been digging, and Chris Wolf joins me now. Chris, tell me what you found.
Well, no two cases are exactly the same, Aaron, but in 1965, a 19-year-old Marine named Bobby Garwood went missing from his base in Da Nang in South Vietnam and reemerged 14 years later in 1979, long after the war had finished, as the last POW to come out of Indochina alive. And he was treated with some acclaim initially, and there were widespread belief in his stories about other Americans still being held there. But then the military investigated and ended up prosecuting him as a deserter and collaborator and dishonorably discharged him from the military and stripped him of his back pay and all his future chances at getting benefits from the military.
So Garwood, that's one guy. Any more examples?
Yeah, at the end of the Korean War, there was a large prisoner exchange, and some Americans chose to stay in North Korea. Others came back and did face military justice. They were, again, prosecuted sometimes for desertion, but more often for collaborating. And several of them, in fact, ended up doing hard time in military prison for a few years.
And what they're being prosecuted for is what?
Well, it's a variety of things. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you know, there are specific ways that you are deemed to have deserted your post or deserted your duty by taking an unauthorized absence, for example, going AWOL and then, you know, not returning to base for whatever reason. And of course, one of those reasons could be that you're captured by the enemy. So you may have gone off base for a drink. It could have happened in Vietnam occasionally and then been captured. So what are you? Are you a deserter? Are you AWOL? Are you a POW? You could be all three.
Right. And that bears pointing out in the case now with Bergdahl is he could be both a deserter and be punished for that eventually and be a POW deserving of all the U.S. can bring to free him.
Correct.
Okay. So Bergdahl prisoner exchange, very public today. Has that happened before?
Yeah, the U.S. has a long history of exchanges of prisoners of war. But there is a gray area here of whether the people who are released in exchange for Bergdahl counted as prisoners of war or some other kind of detainee.
Right. In this case, whether or not they were terrorists. That's the U.S. context. What about elsewhere in the world?
Well, I think one good example that we could look at with a similar kind of experience of dealing with insurgency slash guerrilla terrorist violence would be Israel. Israel, as you know, Aaron, as a former Middle East correspondent for the World, Israel's happy to exchange dozens or hundreds of prisoners in return for just the remains of dead soldiers. But of course, the biggest example would have been in 2011 when Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier who has been held by the Palestinians for 5 years in the Gaza Strip, was released in exchange for over 1,000 detainees. And amongst them were 280 men who are serving life terms for planning and perpetrating acts of terror, which may have claimed over the lives of over 500 Israelis altogether.
Now, that Shalit swap and presumably the Bergdahl exchange is based on this leave no man behind philosophy. Is that universal with militaries around the world?
No. As you may have heard the Pentagon spokesman say this week, that it doesn't matter if you fall off a ship or you're pushed or you jump, the ship's going to come back and get you. That's not always the case. Sometimes the mission is more important and the convoy has to carry on and leave you in the water regardless.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Aaron.
We wanted to get a sense of what military veterans think of that no man left behind policy. So we turned to our online community of vets, and not surprisingly, the response was overwhelmingly supportive. Eric in Seattle even challenged the idea that anyone would question it. He says there's a moral obligation never to abandon a fellow soldier. Stephanie from Fairfield, California, calls it a sacred bond for those who serve. And Corrine from Lansing, Michigan, says it's a commitment the nation has made to every service member. If you're a vet and want to help with our ongoing coverage, join our network by texting RETURN to 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. Israel's parliament picks a new president next Tuesday. It's not really that big of a deal. The prime minister is the one with the power. Israel's president is largely a ceremonial figure. But this year, there's more competition for the post than any other year in Israel's history. And as Daniel Estern reports from Jerusalem, whoever gets picked for the ceremonial job will have large shoes to fill.
The outgoing president is Shimon Peres. Worldwide, he's considered Israel's most popular elder statesman. Last year, he turned 90. And guess who came to his birthday party?
Thank you.
Bill Clinton, Sharon Stone, Robert De Niro, and his favorite singer, Barbara.
Shimon Peres gives me hope that Israel will meet its challenges because he knows that the key to a better tomorrow is the fact that, as President Clinton said, we are more alike than we are different. And when you really think about it, I mean, we're all just people. People who need people.
Yeah, Barbara just couldn't help herself. There's a cult of personality surrounding President Peres that doesn't exist with any other Israeli politician today. World leaders hug him. He's a vocal advocate for peace. And in this music video, he wants you to friend him on Facebook for peace.
Be my friend for peace. I want to hear your voice.
Shimon Peres has been in politics since Israel's founding. He was prime minister twice, served in nearly every cabinet position, won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1994 for peace talks with the Palestinians. So now the race is on for a new president, a position that's almost all symbolic. In recent weeks, it came out that Netanyahu called the ultimate symbol Elie Wiesel, the famous Holocaust survivor and author, and asked him to run for president. He turned it down. Avraham Diskin, who's been a political advisor to a number of politicians, explains why Netanyahu would turn to someone like Elie Wiesel, who doesn't even live in Israel.
It's in order to have someone who symbolizes, you know, the Jewish people, who symbolizes the past, and also someone who probably wouldn't make too much trouble to the elected bodies of Israel, the Knesset and the government.
The president of Israel functions a lot like the Queen of England. They cut ribbons, meet elementary school students, you know, a lot of pomp and circumstance, which philosopher Gabriel Motzkin knows a lot about. He runs the Van Leer Research Institute, which is right behind the president's official residence.
That's right. He's our neighbor, and we do see him from time to time. Every time they do the national anthem or there's a visiting guest, I hear the music. So we're close neighbors.
So I have to ask you, if it were up to you, if you could choose anyone living today to be the president of Israel, who would it be?
Bill Clinton.
Seriously, Bill Clinton?
I'd vote for him in a second.
But what connection does he have to Israel?
He was very successful in the last set of peace negotiations.
The Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations in the year 2000.
He's a witty person. He's smart. You'd like to have him over for dinner.
Motzkin basically ruled out everyone else one by one. He said there's simply a dearth of qualified people for the role. Down the street, I met another neighbor of the president, student Tali Arkushin, who rents an apartment right across the street from the president's residence.
I think I'd choose Hillary Clinton, actually.
Totally random, I swear.
I think she'd be a great Israeli president. She's got the look, she's got the... Yeah, I think she would be good for the job.
She's not Israeli, she's not Jewish.
Well, you could work on that. All that's reversible, so she would make a good neighbor. Maybe I could ask for sugar if I'm out of sugar, or eggs, or anything we're out of. I would give it a try.
Elections are June 10th. Hillary Clinton is not running. For the president of Israel, at least. For the world, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Tomorrow, the president of France, François Hollande, will be hosting foreign dignitaries to commemorate the 70th anniversary of D-Day. The commemoration will conclude with a state dinner, or actually two dinners. That's right, Hollande will be dining twice, once with President Obama and then again with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Hollande evidently doesn't want to be in the middle of that awkward conversation. John Mueller dealt with some similar headaches when he served as White House chef under three presidents from 1992 to 2005.
The closest thing that came to anything remotely close to that would be when the Palestinians and the Israelis signed a peace accord back in, I think, 93. And we were going to have a dinner to commemorate it, but they said, we're willing to sign this paper together, but we're not ready to break bread together. So that dinner never materialized that evening.
So neither Israelis nor Palestinians showed up?
No. They said they were not ready to do that point in time.
So how do you decide what to cook for whom and what not to cook? Do you try to cook food from the home country?
They are visiting America, so I like to give them a little taste of what we have to offer. The State Department will forward to us dietary restrictions from their embassy, and I will wait to get those before I even start constructing a menu.
Have you ever encountered any strange dietary restrictions?
Nothing really peculiar. I mean, you had a few allergies you had to deal with, and the Chancellor of Germany, I think, preferred, American beef and lamb. Surprise, surprise, you know. But I think the most unusual request I did see was about 10-plus years ago, there was the Prime Minister of Italy coming to visit, and I got the dietary restrictions in, and reading it, it said, does not eat onions, garlic, and tomatoes. And I said, my goodness. Does it
An
say,
Italian doesn't eat onions, garlic, and tomatoes?
That is exactly what was said on there. And I read it six times to make sure I was reading all the words correctly. And I was like, my goodness, the guy's got to be an imposter. My take on it afterwards was that maybe when he goes out on the road, everybody puts garlic, onions, and tomatoes in his food. He's like, you know, I get that enough at home. You know, just because I'm Italian doesn't mean I have to eat it every day.
Do you remember what you made him?
I did make an awesome buco of salmon and scallops with a mussel saffron sauce.
Oh.
And I stayed away from tomatoes, garlic, and onions, you know?
Wow, that sounds good. Any flubs that you can remember where what you made really didn't go down very well?
I remember one time, and ironically, it was with the Israelis. We got a chance to play with some different food sometimes when it was like a working lunch. We had lots of what we called working lunches and working dinners. A visiting head would come to the White House. They'd have some meetings, and then we'd have a luncheon or a dinner. So I put rabbit on the menu once when the Israelis were there, and then somebody from the delegation came back to me and said,
"It's not kosher."
Rabbit's kind of in that funny little world. It's almost like a scavenger. It's not really 100% kosher, but I mean, it's good. But there's no issue, but just to let you know that to kind of maybe stay away from it next time.
Finally, Chef Mueller, what is it about breaking bread that's so important to diplomats and so integral to the diplomatic process?
I mean, they always have a meeting first and they go through the mechanics of that. And I don't think they bring over to the dinner table a lot of what's happened at the meeting. So the meeting is the meeting to talk about whatever issues there are. But when they go to sit down, they get a chance to enjoy themselves and maybe have a little bit more general discussion about things and maybe not get so heavy into what the meetings were all about. So it's a get to know you. And I think it's very, very important. And that's what food does, is bring people together.
Chef John Mueller, he was the White House chef under three presidents from 1992 through 2005. He is also the author of the cookbook, Dining at the White House. Chef, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, and you have a great day.
Okay, so we know now what motivates diplomats. Here's a question. What motivates koalas, that cuddly supermodel of the animal world? When you see them, they're usually clinging to trees. But did you ever wonder why? Well, probably not. But some scientists in Australia did. A team of researchers from the University of Melbourne has just published a study that suggests koalas hug trees to keep cool. Michael Carney is one of the study co-authors.
One of the questions we wanted to ask about the koala is, do they use behavior at all to regulate their temperature? Are they able to choose places in their trees that make them a bit more comfortable?
The team used a thermal camera to take pictures of a koala population on French Island near Melbourne on a particularly hot day.
It was so obvious once we got those pictures back what the koalas were doing. They were putting their bottoms into the cool forks of these trees and dumping all their excess heat into the tree.
The team watched the koalas seeking out lower branches and laying listless and flat along the surface to cool down. The fur on a koala's belly is thinner than the fur on their back, so they push that part of their body against the tree as much as possible. And the type of tree was also a deciding factor for where the koalas hung out.
It turned out that the acacia was actually the best one to be in for losing heat into the trunks. But they don't eat the leaves of the acacia trees. They only eat the leaves of the eucalypt trees. So they were leaving their food tree and going into these non-food trees because we think for this very reason that they're able to dump heat more effectively into the trees on the hot days.
Carney predicts koalas will use this behavior more and more as climate change leads to more extreme heat waves. Now, don't you just want to go to Australia and hug a tree or a koala?
Red-backed funnel-web, blue-ringed octopus, taipan, tiger snake, anabox, jellyfish, stonefish, and the poison thing that lives in a shell that spikes you when you pick it up. Come to Australia, you might accidentally get killed. Your life's constantly under threat. Have you been bitten yet? You've only got 3 minutes left before a massive coronary breakdown.
You can see thermal imagery of a koala at PRI.org. And coming up, the bows that nearly brought down an orchestra on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. It's something nearly all of us do eventually, me right at 16. We head to the DMV to get a driver's license. But for a long time, one specific group of people couldn't do that. Undocumented immigrants. Now, more and more states are passing laws letting them get licenses, provided they pass the exam. Our story today from Los Angeles and reporter Valerie Hamilton.
Juan Carlos Lopez still has a picture of his family's first car.
It was a 1974, a Dodge Duster.
They got it when they got to L.A. from Mexico in the 1990s. Lopez was 15, and he helped his dad buy the Duster with money from his job. But this story doesn't have a happy ending.
2 weeks later, I got pulled over by, you know, police, and they took away the car because my dad didn't have a license.
You can't get a California license if you don't have the legal papers to live in the U.S. So that means every time one of the state's more than 2 million undocumented immigrants takes the wheel, they're breaking the law. But that's changing. There's a new law in California, and other states too, that will let undocumented immigrants get licensed starting next year. And there's a lot more to these laws than just avoiding a ticket.
It also means to be more sure of themselves, to be able to freely go from one place to another without fear of getting stopped and getting your car confiscated.
Armando Botello is a spokesman for California's DMV. He says licensing undocumented drivers is the best way to make sure they're driving safely. That makes sense if they can pass the test. When undocumented immigrants took Nevada's written driver's test this year, most of them failed. There are concerns that could happen in California, too.
They are not prepared yet.
Carlos Sada is head of the Mexican consulate in L.A. Since most undocumented immigrants in California are from Mexico, the consulate is taking the lead in getting Spanish speakers prepared. They've been handing out DMV practice tests, and Sada says the results aren't good. It's not that people don't know how to drive.
In Mexico, it's harder to drive. If you come from Mexico, Mexico City, you are like a PhD in driving.
But people who learn how to drive outside of the U.S. may not know U.S. laws.
Of course they know how to drive, but do they know the rules? That is a problem.
So the Mexican consulate is working to prep immigrants for the exam, along with community groups, colleges, and the DMV. There are practice tests, a smartphone app, and classes in English for the driver's test. Here's an audio version of the driver's manual for people who can't read and write.
A driver who wants to pass a bicyclist must do so at a distance no less than 3 feet.
Yeah, it's just as boring as you remember. But if you want a license, there's no shortcut. And so on a Saturday morning, a room full of undocumented immigrants buckles down to study. They go through sample test questions, learn speed limits and rights of way. Juan Carlos Lopez is teaching the class. He's the guy whose family lost their Dodge Duster all those years ago. He eventually got his green card and a driver's license, and now he's a driver's ed teacher. He asks the students if they drive already. A room full of hands goes up. That's Eliseo Toledano. He's 40, and he learned to drive when he came to California from Mexico 12 years ago. He's never been to driving school, and he's learning a lot today. He can't wait to take the test.
Tres veces me ha parado la policía.
He says the police have stopped him and taken away his car 3 times for driving without a license.
This is a big opportunity. I've been waiting for the license for 12 years.
Elizabeth Silverio is a single mom. She says raising a child in California, she's had no choice but to drive, licensed or not. But she's played it as safe as she could. Years ago, she got herself a copy of the California Driver's Manual.
I studied the book without the license for my security, for my own, and for my daughter.
And that may be all it takes. After all those people failed the test in Nevada this year, word got out that you had to study for it. Now, undocumented immigrants there are passing at about the same rate as everyone else. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Los Angeles.
Finally today, a tale about overcoming musical hardship. It stars an orchestra from Hungary that was invited to play at Lincoln Center in New York. The orchestra wowed the critics with a, quote, stunning all Dvorak performance. But for a while, the performance was in doubt. The orchestra had run afoul of a federal regulation that bans anyone from bringing ivory into the U.S. For an explanation, we reached orchestra manager Stefan Englert on his cell phone.
Yeah, the Budapest Festival Orchestra had 2 concerts in Lincoln Center, and we brought our instruments by cargo. And with the instruments, we brought also the string bows. And as we knew that the regulations for the import of ivory is tightened up, we made photos and we got a certificate that these bows do not contain ivory. And then we were a bit surprised when we arrived that 7 of the bows didn't went through the customs. And we couldn't take them to our concerts in New York.
Why do bows have ivory in them?
Not all of them have it. It's just in the tip. It's a small little part. And just traditionally, ivory was used for that.
The kind of shiny bit at the end, right?
Yes, it's just the tip of the bow.
So how did you deal with the problem here when you were in the U.S.?
Well, we had to find a solution. And luckily, we have good friends at the Lincoln Center. And they helped us to get in touch with other professional musicians. And we did rent these bows from other musicians, which is, of course, tricky since if someone is playing with a bow for a very, very long time, it is part of an instrument and you are used to a bow. All bows have a different characteristic. And it takes some time to get adjusted to a new bow. It's like a new instrument in a way.
Well, presumably the other musicians from Lincoln Center have pretty good bows, no?
They have pretty good bows, but the point is, even if you have a pretty good instrument and all of a sudden you play on a Stradivari, it doesn't mean automatically that you can cope with it so easily, because it all has a different characteristic. They all have different sizes, different weights, and the human body and this automatism of playing is just used to it.
Do you understand the U.S. concern, though? I mean, certainly illegal ivory is a pretty big problem worldwide, and if people are seeing this lovely stuff on the end of a bow, it could suggest to them that, you know, ivory is worth having.
I completely understand the concerns, but what I don't understand is that there are instruments that have been built a very, very long time ago that they cannot be imported, since these instruments are built, this ivory is used. It is not about producing new ivory for these instruments or for the bows. Plus, we did everything what was required. We even did these passports. We even had these certificates that there is no ivory, but still, 7 of the bows didn't went through.
Huh. Did you get them back in the end?
We got them back, yes. We got them back yesterday when we left. We had to be there at 10 o'clock in the morning with the inspector, and we had to pay a fine, of course, but we got them back, luckily.
So because of this, using these different bows, did the Dvorak actually sound differently?
I don't think it sounded very differently, since it's a group. And basically, our musicians are highly flexible. They had some time to adjust to it. At the very beginning, it is a certain kind of anxiety or insecureness, because you have to adjust to new things. And that's, of course, in this kind of complex production of music, always an issue. But the performances have been magnificent. The Eighth Symphony, this is just special symphony of Dvorak. And this was just an incredible, intensive performance.
Stefan Englert, many thanks.
You're welcome.
The Budapest Festival Orchestra, playing here with borrowed bows, wraps up the show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter, and thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.